Welcome to Bloomberg Law for this April 1st. I'm June Grosso with Greg Storr. Universal tried to have the lawsuit against its hit movie Straight Outta Compton thrown straight out of court, but a judge is allowing former NWA manager Gerald Heller to go forward with his suit, claiming the movie defamed him. The movie Straight Outta Compton was an Academy Award-nominated film that grossed more than $200 million at the box office last year, a docudrama about the meteoric rise and fall of the pioneering rap group NWA.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
People are scared of you guys. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want NWA? Let's give them NWA.
Former NWA manager Jerry Heller sued Universal, the director, the screenwriters, Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, and a host of other people for $110 million, saying the movie falsely depicted him as a sleazy manager who attempted to defraud the members of the group and caused its breakup. Universal and the other defendants tried to get the lawsuit thrown straight out of court, but a federal judge kept the lawsuit alive while knocking out one of Heller's key claims. Greg?
Hello, June. Our guests today are Mark Litwack, a veteran entertainment lawyer at Mark Litwack & Associates in Los Angeles. He doubles as an adjunct professor at the USC Law School. And Frederick Tesi, a former federal prosecutor and now a partner at Panitz Schwartz in Philadelphia. He's also an expert in intellectual property. Welcome to you both. Mark, let me start with you. One of Heller's claims was for misappropriation of likeness. In other words, he claimed that the movie makers basically created a Jerry Heller character without his permission. Judge Fitzgerald threw that claim out. Why did the judge do that, and was that a sound decision?
Well, in this situation, like numerous other cases, you have a conflict between one person's rights under the First Amendment, which is usually the journalist or the filmmaker, and another person's right to control their right of publicity, which is the right to control the use of your name and likeness, usually in a commercial sense for like merchandising and endorsements. And in most cases, but not in all cases, the courts have found that the First Amendment right is the paramount right, and that under the First Amendment, people have a right to, you know, speak freely and talk about other people without their permission. And the courts have treated products like Time magazine or anything that has protected content like a play or a book differently than other products like a coffee cup or a T-shirt. So if you were taking someone's name and likeness and putting it on your brand of spaghetti sauce, you probably would have a tough time defending that if you didn't have a deal with the person who you put on the product. But in regard to products that have protected First Amendment content, like books, movies, and TV, they usually do not prevail and because the First Amendment rights of the other person are considered paramount.
And, Fred, as with all these biopics and we had the Hurt Locker case, has it become the point where if you're doing something about a controversy or something public that it's almost impossible to claim misappropriation of likeness?
Well, I mean, I think what your other guest said is really kind of hits the nail on the head. It's not that it's impossible, June. It's just that the courts balance the filmmaker or the journalist's First Amendment rights to make a movie or a documentary, or in this case, kind of a slash, you know, documentary slash fictional movie. Because inherent in your question is the fact that, you know, you talk about these historical events. Well, that's what gives rise to their value. That's what gives rise to the importance of a movie about those things. And so, you know, and that's the kind of speech that the First Amendment is set there to protect. I mean, not all speech, not all First Amendment speech is created equally. As I think Mark indicated, you know, commercial free speech is not as valuable as journalistic free speech, and so, or is not as protectable. And I think that's what you're seeing in all these instances.
Mark, we do have some claims in this lawsuit that are still alive, in particular defamation claims. How hard is it going to be for Jerry Heller in a case like this to show that he was defamed and actually recover damages?
It's going to be very hard for him because the trial judge here concluded that he's a limited public figure And the rules for public figures and public officials prevailing in defamation lawsuits is much different than for private individuals. In order for Mr. Heller to prevail, he has to show not only that what was said about him was false and hurt his reputation, he has to show that the defendants acted with reckless disregard of the truth. They've acted with actual malice. In other words, when they made this movie, they knew it was false, or they acted recklessly and knew there was a high likelihood that it would be false. That's a very, very high standard to meet. And the journalist, for instance, let's say the journalist was not filmmakers but was from the National Enquirer, they can come into court and they can say, look, you know, we got it wrong. We admit we got it wrong, and we were negligent, and we were sloppy in our reporting.
The actor Paul Giamatti plays the role of Jerry Heller, the music manager behind NWA's Rise to Fame and Straight Outta Compton, the highest-grossing musical biopic of all time. But the real Jerry Heller says the movie defames him, painting him as a sleazy manager who exploited the members of the group. In a lawsuit, Heller says the film is littered with false statements and scenes. He lists them in the complaint, one being that he was fired by Eazy-E, who accused him of illegal activity.
This about you. And you can stop acting like you ain't never done nothing wrong.
Man, I know that you're upset. I understand. But I'm asking you. I'm advising you. Take a breath, okay?
I'm going to look at the paperwork, Eric.
You can stop giving advice as of now. Here's what's about to happen. I'm going to get NWA back together, and you ain't going to have nothing to do with it this time.
Heller's lawsuit survived a motion to dismiss by the defendants, but the judge knocked out a key claim, and Heller has to file a second complaint that complies with the judge's order. We've been talking with former federal prosecutor Frederick Tesi, an intellectual property litigator and partner at Panitch Schwarzy, and entertainment attorney Mart Litwack of Mart Litwack and Associates. Fred, so he's going to get another shot at filing a complaint, but the judge said he wanted some real specifics so that he can find out what's plausible or not. Tell me what kind of a complaint he has to file now.
Well, you know, it's interesting, June. This case was originally filed in California State Court and then removed and taken to federal court because one of the allegations are copyrights, which are exclusively federal court jurisdiction. Now, without getting kind of too far into the legal weeds, in federal court, it's what the law calls notice pleading, which means that the pleadings have to be sufficient enough to put the other side on notice as to what the charges are against them. And what the judge said is that despite the fact that it's only notice pleading, he wants an amended complaint from this guy that lays out, I don't want to say chapter and verse, but with lays out sufficient detail so that the defendants are on notice as to what the false and defamatory statements are. Because the complaint, and I read through it, it's kind of like a lot of blunderbuss, kind of broad, sweeping statements, which, you know, is not enough, even though for notice pleading it's not enough. So the judge wants them to kind of, you know, kind of put up or shut up. That's where we are.
Mark, this all sounds like a pretty stiff test, both what you've laid out and what Fred has laid out. And I'm wondering, you know, from Jerry Heller's standpoint, he sees this as the makers of a movie created this character named Jerry Heller, made him look really bad, had a lot of falsehoods in the movie, and made $200 million off it. Explain why, if that is the case, why he shouldn't get compensation for that portrayal.
Because the courts and the U.S. Supreme Court are very concerned about protecting free expression. And if every time a filmmaker or the New York Times wrote something that was factually inaccurate and hurt someone's reputation, and they were vulnerable to $1 million in awards against them, that would chill their speech and it would inhibit them. And free speech is extremely important in this country. And the courts tend to side with those people who are exercising that right.
Fred, though the judge said was skeptical about the road ahead for Heller at the hearing, he did write in his order that even permitting defendants some breathing room as to the events portrayed in the film, the implications the film seems to make could at least possibly support a meritorious claim for defamation. And he lists eight things. What are the chances that Heller could survive a motion for defamation? Because he also alleges that there's actual malice in some of this.
Well, he has to, because the judge, as Mark indicated, found that he was a limited public figure. So actual malice is a much harder standard to meet for defamation, which I thought was one of the counts that got thrown out. To answer your question, June, anybody with basically what is about $300 now can file a complaint and make allegations. And no case is ever over, when I was a plaintiff's lawyer, I used to say, is ever over till I'm outspending the defendant's money. And so he's a long way from winning. And you have to remember, too, this is what's a motion to dismiss at an early stage of the pleadings. Under the law, everything that Heller put in his complaint has to be assumed to be true. That's the standard. You must accept all his allegations as true. And so making these allegations and actually prevailing on them are two very, very different things. And from what I've read, apparently, a lot of these things that people are saying, the movie did not portray him as actually breaking the law. The movie did not really portray him in the false light that he's alleged. And, you know, he's a long way from winning.
Just one thing, Fred, from this, what we just heard, that little scene. So in the room are Eazy-E and Heller, allegedly. That's all in the scene. So who is going to be there to contradict what Heller says happened? I mean, that seems to be the problem with these biops.
Well, first of all, I mean, it's, you know, that raises a great question. For the purposes of his allegations, you have to, it's what's in the movie, right? It's not exactly, well, I guess on some level it is. These people are going to come in and say, no, that's not the way it happened. And truth is a defense to, you know, to a defamation or you know, a slander count. So, I mean, the answer is whoever was in the room, well, I guess some of those guys aren't even around anymore, but whoever's in the room, or whatever facts or information, that's Heller's job to find it, get it, and bring it forward and use it to support his case.
Mark, do lawsuits like this very often succeed? How often does somebody win a defamation case over a biopic or another movie that's based on real-life events?
I would say it's pretty rare. We have recently the Wolf of Wall Street case, where Nikki Rugrat Kossoff was the character for a person whose real name was Andrew Green, and most of that case has already been thrown out. But in that case, of course, the fictional character who Andrew Green alleges is him because of the bad toupee he wore had a fictional name. In this case, the filmmakers didn't even try to disguise the name of the manager. They used his real name. So, in a sense, the identification issue is not really going to be contested here. It clearly was about this manager. But I think he's going to have a tough time because let's assume he can convince a judge or a jury that what he said, what was said about him was defamatory. He still has to prove actual malice, and that's going to be very difficult. I have to assume on this movie that some lawyers for the studio cleared the script before it went into production, and they made some effort to make sure that it was fairly accurate.
Fred, does he get this one last chance to amend this complaint and then that's it, or can he come back with the complaint and the judge says, well, you still need this and that and come back again?
You know what, that's actually a more complicated question than you think. The answer is the judge can allow him to kind of amend and amend and amend, and I'm embarrassed to say that I've been in cases where I've had to amend the complaint three times, but that's a story for another day. I suspect from the judge's ruling and what I've read about it that he's going to give him one more opportunity to amend his complaint, and then if he rules, and whichever counts get thrown out, those are going to be out of the case. Now, if he doesn't throw the whole case out and leave certain counts in, then this issue about whether or not he was right to have dismissed counts at the beginning of the case will not be adjudicated by the Ninth Circuit until after the case is over and he's gone and gotten a verdict or the case has been dismissed on summary judgment and it's gone up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Mark, we have just about a minute left. Would this be a different case if Jerry Heller hadn't written his own memoirs about his experience?
Yes, I think it might be a different case because I think it's hard, as the judge noted in his decision, that Jerry Heller thrust himself in the limelight writing a book about his own experiences. So it's hard for him now to say, you know, he's not at least a limited, you know, public figure. And that, of course, imposes this much higher standard. There's also the copyright infringement case, which wasn't directly addressed by this judge. And without looking at his book that he wrote and the film, it's hard to say whether there was any copyright infringement, but simply taking facts from the book and putting it in the movie would not be enough to sustain a copyright infringement cause of action.
Well, thank you both. That's entertainment attorney Mart Litwack of Mart Litwack & Associates and Frederick Tesi, intellectual property litigator and partner at Panitch Schwarzy. Thanks for being on Bloomberg Law. Now let's take a look at the top story on BloombergLaw.com. Big-name musicians, including Katy Perry, Billy Joel, and Rod Stewart, are pushing for changes to a U.S. copyright law they claim robs them of potential earnings. Dozens of top artists have banded together with managers and music labels in filing petitions to the Copyright Office asking that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act be reformed. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Law. With all due respect, is next for our Washington, D.C. audience. Bloomberg Best is next for our listeners in New York, Boston, and San Francisco. And at 5:45, be sure to tune into uninterrupted coverage of the president's speech on nuclear proliferation. Have a great weekend.